MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's that time of the week. It's a Tuesday afternoon and Dr. Ross Walker joins me. Hello, Ross.
G'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm all right. I was driving down the highway today from the Hunter to work, and I thought to myself, looking forward to talking to Dr. Ross Walker. It's just a beautiful day, not a cloud in the sky. It was lovely. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, it's going to be like that for the rest of the week, which is fantastic.
Let's get stuck into this. Now, the first story today is it says that swapping soda water for tea or coffee can slash type 2 diabetes complications by 20%.
Can I just interrupt? No, yeah. It's not soda water. It's actually sugary sweetened drinks like soft drinks.
Okay.
The Americans call it soda.
Okay. So
it soft drinks,
it's Coke and Passiona and all that sort of stuff. Right.
Yeah. And so what they did was they took a bunch of people, 15,000 adults with proven type 2 diabetes, followed them for 18 years. So a huge study for a long time. And found, you're not going to believe this, Brent, but some people would have a soft drink per day.
Oh, I can believe it. I can believe it. I worked with a guy who walked around every day with a 2-litre bottle of Pepsi, and he consumed it every day.
Yeah, which is just outrageous. So they compared people who had the highest intake of sugar-sweetened beverages, whether we're talking about soft drinks or commercial fruit juices. So at least the highest intake was considered at least one standard can or more per day compared with people who had less than one per month. And they found that those who had the highest intake had, wait for this, a 20% increased risk for death, 25% increased risk for cardiovascular disease, 29% increased risk for cardiovascular death. But those people who then switched from soft drink consumption or commercial fruit juice consumption to better alternatives for fluid is a thing called coffee, tea. A lot of people have heard of this new one. It's called water. People who have up to 6 cups a day of coffee, tea or water reduce their risk for death by 26% for coffee, 21% for tea, 23% for water. And people say, oh, well, look, I'll have the artificially sweetened drinks. No, there was only a 4% reduction in death risk compared with the figures that I've given you before. So the reality here, or the bottom line here is choose your fluid intake wisely.
I thought it was interesting that they said that people who drank 6 cups daily of, and it's obvious that water, you know, we hear everywhere, we read everywhere that, you know, we should be drinking more water. But I was surprised to see that they included in this drinking tea and coffee. And they say that, you know, if you drank up to 6 drinks of daily of coffee and tea, as well as water, it lowers the risk of death during that was during the study that they did.
Yeah, well, look, I don't think people should say, okay, well, I'll just have my 6 cups of coffee a day. We're not talking about that. I think people should have a couple of cups of coffee a day, a couple of cups of tea a day, and maybe a couple of glasses of water a day. That's what I basically do. I think that's what we all should be doing. And I think we should be avoiding soft drinks like the plague and commercial fruit juices.
What about diet drinks? How bad are they for us?
I think they're bad for you. I don't think there's much difference. That, as I said, a 4% reduction in death risk for people who went from the sugary drinks to the diet drinks, that's not much as opposed to the 20-plus percent benefits you're getting from coffee, tea and water.
Is it true that some artificial sweeteners have been linked to an increased risk of cancer?
There is some suggestion there. The problem with all of these linkings to increasing cancer risk is a lot of the studies have been done in experimental animals, and you can almost prove that any chemical in certain doses will cause a cancer in an experimental animal. You can't always extrapolate that to human beings. But, for example, they've looked at what we call observational trials where they look at people who had cola-based drinks. And they found that there was a higher rate of cancer in people who had cola-based drinks because of the melamine colouring in the cola-based drinks. But also the artificial sweeteners have again been linked to higher cancer rates, but only in experimental animals. It hasn't been proven yet in any human studies. But I still, just because that hasn't been proven, A, doesn't mean it doesn't happen, and B, doesn't mean we should be encouraging people to use artificially sweeteners for anything, personally.
I read that it says the takeaway from this is diluting the body's volume with most fluids, will be beneficial in diabetes because it helps the body get rid of excess sugar.
Yeah, that's true to some extent. But also, when you're delivering a fluid that is just solid sugar, we're talking anywhere between 8 to 12 teaspoons of sugar in one of these standard cans of soft drink, you're markedly straining the insulin resources in the body and thus making the pancreas go into failure. And look, type 2 diabetes is not a pancreatic disease. It's a disease of the insulin receptor on the surface of normal cells, like liver cells and muscle cells, et cetera, et cetera. But then your pancreas has to make more insulin to force the nutrients into the cell because the cells are resistant to the effect of insulin. So that's what insulin resistance means. It means the insulin isn't working as well at the cellular level, so you've got to make more insulin. Thus, the pancreas says, Brent, I can't keep doing this, and goes into failure, and thus diabetes.
I've got to say, Ross, when I read this study, I personally was disappointed that it didn't include red wine there with the coffee, tea and water.
Well, there are other causes, other studies that show some potential red wine benefit, but we did speak a few weeks ago on the show about the 107 trials put together showing that no alcohol gives any benefit at all. And we discussed that and discussed some of the potential problems with that study. But again, I think it's irresponsible for any doctor to promote alcohol or to encourage people to drink. My message is, if you're drinking 4 or 5 drinks a day, pull it back to a safe intake of 1 to 2 drinks a day. And the evidence shows that red wine is healthier for you than beer or spirits.
Almost 1.2 million Australians are living with type 2 diabetes. Studies show that intermittent fasting can help manage the condition. Some research even shows that intermittent fasting can reverse type 2 diabetes. So this study talks and looks at fasting, as in intermittent fasting, versus calorie restriction.
And the reason I wanted to talk about this, mate, is because I don't think this is doable. Because they took 209 adults, average age about 58, who were clearly obese. Their BMI was around 35. And they put one-third onto this time-restricted eating, which is only eating between 8 to 12 midday, so having a 20-hour fast where you only take in 30% of your normal energy requirement for 3 non-consecutive days a week. So it's a pretty arduous way of eating. The second group reduced their total caloric intake every day to 70% of what they normally eat. So cut down what they're eating by about a third, which is more doable, but still a lot of people find it hard. And the third, wait for this one, we're given a standard weight loss booklet with advice on how to lose weight. And they found that after 12 months, the study went for 6 months and they followed them up for 12 months. And after 12 months, they found that there was significant weight loss, best in the time-restricted eating group, second best in the calorie-restricted group, and the booklet didn't do much on this. Of course, the person ate the booklet. But this is the problem, that after the 12 months, still 78% of people in the calorie-restricted group had continued to eat less calories, but only 42% of people in the time-restricted eating had continued to follow that because it's too hard to follow. So I think when we say to people, this is what I'm saying about weight loss to people. Firstly, don't expect a benefit within the first few months. You might lose a few kilos because you've basically re-equilibrated water and muscle in your body, but you haven't lost any fat. It takes months and months and months of any dietary program for you to start breaking down the really entrenched fat that's been there for years and years and years. You might get a bit of superficial fat gone, but the stuff you really want to get that's stuck in your organs and stuff everywhere else, that's going to take you months and months to do. And the problem is, for most Homo sapiens, they just don't have the willpower. They don't have the discipline to keep that going. So I just say to people, look, do it like this. Get rid of unnecessary food. So we don't need to eat biscuits, cakes, lollies, snacks. No one needs to do that at all. So that's got to stop. Number two, just cut back generally in what you eat. Eat off smaller plates, don't have second helpings, avoid dessert, don't graze during the day. People say to me, oh, Doc, I get starving at 10:30. I say, get over it. The body was meant for a bit of hunger. So it's not a crime for people to be hungry, and you don't have to have 3 solid meals a day as well. So just cut back generally on what you eat. keep your grog down. So the only way over the age of 50 to lose weight is cut back calories, cut back refined carbs, so white death, sugar, white bread, pasta, potatoes and rice, and cut back your grog. That's the way to lose weight. It's 80% food, it's 20% exercise. So I think these really rigid approaches like time-restricted eating or even pretty rigid calorie restriction, it just doesn't work.
But I fast every day, nothing from really probably 9 a.m. until 6 p.m. So that's 9 hours. By 6 o'clock, though, I'm starving and probably tend to eat more because of it.
No, look at you, mate. You're a greyhound, so I wouldn't worry about that at all. So, no. You can tell people who are carrying too much weight, they go, oh, doctor, I don't eat much. Rubbish. Be honest with yourself. You can't get to the obese stage just by bad metabolism. There is almost always, in 95 cases out of 100, excessive caloric intake versus reduced energy output from exercise and movement.
Ross, can you explain the link between intermittent fasting and reduced markers for type 2 diabetes?
The link is pretty straightforward. You just think about how we were designed. We were designed to wander around a jungle with a spear for 30, 40 years. So you ate when the food was available. So therefore, your pancreas worked based on that. So if you have intermittent fasting, you're going back to almost your normal physiology. So your pancreas is getting a rest. But if you're continually putting food into the system, the pancreas is continually have to flog insulin into the system, and eventually it fails. So if you then go intermittent fasting, give that pancreatic rest for what they're talking about, 16, 20 hours a day, you then don't get as much insulin output. With less insulin output, the insulin receptors actually recover and work better.
That's a very restricted intermittent fasting window of 4 hours. We've seen lots of different intermittent fasting, if you like, diets. For people that want to give it a crack, I mean, what are the hours that you shouldn't eat during the day? How long should you have between meals? Like, should you eat between, say, 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. and then have nothing for the rest of the day, and then have a light meal at maybe 7 o'clock at night or 6 o'clock at night?
I think that's doable. What they're saying in this study, 8 to 12 midday was the eating period, and you fast for 20 hours. Now, again, our society doesn't work like this. We don't have a Mediterranean-style life where we have a good-sized breakfast, biggest meal at lunchtime, and not much in the evening. And you burn off any extra carbs in the hot Mediterranean sun in the morning and the afternoon. What we do is we typically have moderate-sized breakfast, not much for lunch, and then a huge evening meal, and sit in front of that damn thing called television. And so our metabolism is not like a car. You put the fuel in the car, you've got to burn it off when you use it, when you've eaten it. In a car, you can put the fuel and use it when you want to. So I just don't think that sort of restriction is doable. But what is doable is just not to eat as much, for goodness sake.
We're talking to Dr. Ross Walker, Future of Medicine. When we return, the universal flu vaccine.
2HD Breakfast with Richard King.
I went to school at a little tiny school where there was only 30-odd pupils.
Whereabouts was that, Kay?
In the Hunter Valley. It's all mining now, but it used to be our tiny little school. And we used to put our hand on our heart and we used to say, I honour my God, I serve my Queen, I salute the flag. And that's all we had to say. The flag was being raised of a morning.
Weekdays from 5 a.m. Breakfast with Richard King on 2HD. Finance Easy understands that recent times may have been uncertain for business owners, and they'll make it simple to get you finance at competitive rates. Finance Easy takes the hassle out of borrowing money, offering a large range of lenders with rates more competitive than the bank. No more meetings with bank managers, no reams of paperwork, just a few clicks on the website. Visit financeeasy.com.au or call 1300 003 003. Australian Credit Licence Number 392182.
Clark Equipment is going all out at the Tocal Field Days with the entire range of McCormick tractors and Enerossi hay equipment on display. Take advantage of the government tax incentives before June 30 and secure your machine now. Clark Equipment, site 238. You can't miss them.
Experience quality and reliable service. That's the Strike Force Services way. Due to continued growth, Strikeforce Services has been able to provide our valued team members with many new career path opportunities. Whether you are new to the workforce, looking for a new challenge, or just seeking greater flexibility and family time, we could have the position for you. Join the winning team, where everyone is a valued piece of our bigger picture. Experience quality and reliable service. That's the Strike Force Services way.
Osteoarthritis of the knee and hip is a painful chronic joint condition that can interfere with daily life. The Nova Trials team are seeking volunteers with osteoarthritis of the knee or hip to participate in a clinical trial of a potential new injectable medication. If you are experiencing chronic knee or hip pain and not getting lasting relief from pain medications, you may qualify. There are no costs to participate and you'll receive travel expenses for attending appointments at the Nova Trials Katara Clinic. For further information, contact novatrials.com.au today.
Braddon's lawyers are the lawyers you know and trust. So, if you have been injured in an accident and it was not your fault, you may have rights to claim compensation. Braddon's lawyers can assist you with a risk-free, no-obligation assessment of your claim. No matter what type of claim you have, call 1800 848 848 today or book an online appointment at braddons.com.au. Braddon's lawyers, we do support you in your claim for compensation. Terms and conditions apply.
Brain tumour, migraine, dementia.
Have you or someone you love been touched by a brain disorder, disease or injury? Help the ones you love by donating to research today. Visit brainfoundation.org.au.
Catch up with 2HD Local News. Listen online anytime at 2hd.com.au.
We are talking with Dr. Ross Walker. Researchers are reporting progress on a path to a universal flu vaccine, one that would battle all the strains of the virus and give the world a weapon against future flu pandemics. Ross, we're getting a little closer, but slowly, slowly as she goes.
Well, the big question anyone would ask here is why haven't we had some so far? Because you think about what happened with COVID. They hit us with all these vaccines pretty rapidly. But the point is about the COVID vaccine or the influenza vaccine is they hit the superficial part of the virus, that's the surface part that's very easy to get to. And there's a thing called these hemagglutinin proteins that sit on the surface of all influenza viruses. They make a vaccine against that hemagglutinin protein, but next year that mutates to be a different protein that the vaccine doesn't work against. So they've got to keep making new vaccines every year to do something about it. So what these researchers have done is basically lopped off this hemagglutinin head to expose the stem of the virus and then induce an immune response against the stem. And that stem is common to all influenza viruses. So instead of getting the bit that mutates, they're actually getting the bit that's constant. But it's just been so much harder with our immunology up to this point to be able to do that. But now they're able to do it. So they trialed this new vaccine in 52 healthy adults, two shots, and they got a very, very robust response against all forms of influenza A. Now, the common side effects are a bit of headache and local pain in about one in five people who had the shots, but they had a very good broad response. Now, this is only influenza A, not influenza B. But interestingly, every year we get this quadrivalent vaccine, which has two different vaccines against the mutating influenza A strains and then two against the mutating influenza B strains. And that's why many people you see, oh, I've got this dreadful flu and I've been sick for 2 weeks. And other people say, I had a bit of a sniffle. Because typically the dreadful flu that knocks you around is influenza A. The bit of a sniffle tends to be more influenza B. Not in every case, but that tends to be the case. So at the moment, we've got this big strain of influenza A, especially hitting preschools and young children, and making them very ill, and some adults are getting sick from this as well. So you go off and have your flu vaccine now, but hopefully at some stage over the next 5 to 10 years, we'll have this universal vaccine that we'll have once and maybe have it needed again every, say, 5 to 10 years.
Ross, in research for this, I found out that a live attenuated vaccine delivered in the form of a nasal spray was first licensed in 2003, which is 20 years ago. Why is that technology not available en masse 20 years later for the population?
Yeah, I'm not really, well, I can tell you why, my cynical reason why, but I'm not really sure why we haven't got that now. And in fact, a lot of the COVID vaccines were more effective when given intranasally, which is logical because that's how the thing gets in. So if you improve the local immunity to these things in the nose, which is where you're breathing them in, you're going to get a better response. And it's the same thing with influenza. But let me be cynical. It's a lot cheaper to make vaccines that you give into the muscle, which don't work as well, than to actually develop the nasal sprays that go intranasally. So I think it might be cost.
Right. And just quickly before I let you go, researchers have reported on near-death experiences among ICU survivors.
Yeah, this is really interesting. See, there's two groups of thought in science. One, that when somebody has a near-death experience, which is typical of a cardiac arrest, they're completely unconscious, but they say they've felt themselves rise out of the body and look down on the scene, including what's happening in the next room and what's happening in, so they can describe accurately what's going on in the next room, what's happening down in their body. And I had a patient talk to me about this yesterday. But also the transcendental experience, where they say they feel they're travelling through a tunnel up towards a light, and they have a chat with the light, and the light says, "Not your time, back you go," and boom, they're back in their body. Well, this was a slightly different study. They took 126 adults who were in ICU with serious illnesses. Not all of them had cardiac arrests. And they found that 15% actually reported what is described as a pretty typical near-death experience. And they said the people who had most of these near-death experiences had a rated stronger with spirituality, what they called religiosity, but not for other medical parameters as well. So it didn't matter whether it was a cardiac arrest or just a serious illness. But there was about a 15% report for these near-death experiences. And I've got to say, Brent, when I have any patient who's had a cardiac arrest and has been resuscitated, I always ask them, did you have any unusual experiences during the cardiac arrest? 80% say nothing. It was like Kerry Packer, there's nothing there. The other 20%, however, do describe these sort of experiences. And we haven't got time now, but I could tell you a mind-blowing experience that cannot be explained by modern science that one of my patients had.
Okay, I've got to run because I've got to get to a news break. It's always good to catch up with you. We'll look forward to talking to you next Tuesday.
Good on you, mate.
Thank you, Dr. Ross.